This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. In the jungles of Madagascar roams a beast known as the Fusa. It has the frame of a small cougar with a head like a mongoose. It hunts pretty much anything with a heartbeat, including lemurs. And though the Fusa sits atop the food chain in Madagascar, its numbers are dwindling. And I think anything you might know about the Fusa would come from the film Madagascar.
For as long as we can remember, we have been attacked and eaten by the dreaded Fusa.
The Fusa!
Y'all are not attacking us this very instant.
So, my genius plan is this. We will make the New York Giants our friends and keep them close. Then, with Mr. Alex protecting us, we will be safe and never have to worry about the dreaded Fusa ever again.
And that is the sum total of my knowledge of the Fusa, but Luke Dollar is here to fix that for us. Luke is a professor of biology at Pfeiffer University and a leading Fusa researcher with National Geographic. And he will be speaking tomorrow at 7 at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. It is part of the Extreme Mammals exhibit. But first, he is in our studio. Luke Dollar, thanks for being here.
Hi, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us more about the Fusa. How scared should I be?
You shouldn't be very scared at all, but if you're a lemur, your fear would be very appropriately placed. The last thing many lemurs ever see is the teeth of the Fusa closing in on them. And the way Fusa actually have eaten most of the lemurs that we've encountered that are recent prey for these guys is through a face-first bite to the head. Ooh. While using their cat-like claws to eviscerate at the same time. It's pretty quick, but I think it's undeniably classifiable as brutal.
Well, face first, I mean, that tells me they're really quick and stealthy. I mean, obviously, if you know this is your enemy, I would expect more claw marks on the back.
Yeah, they are indeed. Lemurs sleep in trees for the most part in these lumps, if they're social animals, that we just kind of refer to as lemur lumps. And as they're waking up, Fusa will find their way into the trees, crawl along the branches or be on the trunk above or below them, and when the time is right, will pounce and directly and very quickly kill a lemur. Now, there's many places that lemurs sleep. Sometimes they sleep in tree holes, and Fusa are able to climb trees. This is an animal that may weigh more than 20 pounds, but can move through trees as easily as a squirrel. Mm-hmm. It could be 6 feet long from the tip of its nose to the tip of its tail, but it's incredibly agile, and we'll be talking about this a lot more tomorrow night at the museum. But if you sleep in a tree hole, you have even more problems, because if the Fusa finds your tree hole, all it has to do is climb its way to the tree hole, reach in with those claws and pluck you out, and then once again deliver that face first kill bite to the lemur.
No back door. Nope. Well, so tell us more about the Fusa. It is a animal unique to Madagascar, is it not?
It is. More than 80% of all the plants and animals you find on Madagascar are unique to that island. It's been isolated for a really long time as an island, so most of the things that are there haven't had a chance to spread throughout the rest of the world, and that's why a lot of people call Madagascar the eighth continent, because it is so unique and it's been isolated for so long. The Fusa is like a low-slung, lithe cougar. I mentioned before that this thing can be 6 feet long from the tip of the nose to the tip of the tail, but it's less than knee high on us if we were standing right next to one. More than half of its body length is its tail. When you see this tail, you would think, gosh, this thing's got to be something that uses that tail to hang. It would be prehensile like a lot of the New World monkeys do, but it's not. It actually uses this tail and throws it back and forth, much like a tightrope walker when they're walking a tightrope. Would use that bar for balance back and forth. And I've actually seen Fusa in terminal branches of trees no thicker than the diameter of a pencil and manage to actually stay there and balance itself up as it's moving from canopy to canopy. They do most of their long-term traveling on the ground, but when they need to go to the trees to get those big bundles of energy, those lemurs, they're really good at it.
Wow, that's great. And it's got the, as we said earlier, it's got this mongoose-like head, cougar-like body. How do you classify this thing?
The Malagasy carnivores are all classified in their own family now. That's just how unique this group is. It used to be classified in a group called the Viveridae, which are the civets or the genets. But the animals on Madagascar are thought to be so unique that even molecularly they've been able to classify them all in their same group there. The Eupluridae is what it's called. If you could imagine what the common ancestor between the hyenas, the mongooses, and the cats were to look like, it would look a lot like a fusa. In addition to these cat-like claws and this mongoose-like face, it's got incredibly strong teeth and jaw musculature, which, you know, throws back to the hyenas, which have among the highest bite forces of any creature. Wow.
So do we know about its ancestry? What do we think this evolved from?
Madagascar has a really interesting history. It's been where it is for 88 to 100 million years or so, and that actually predates a lot of the things that we see on Earth today, including most mammals, all mammals, really. And it's thought that over the course of the last 88 million years or so, very few ancestral mammal groups actually arrived on Madagascar through rafting, essentially. Big clumps of vegetation float out into the Indian Ocean, and boom, they slam into Madagascar, and these things step off these rafts, and they look around, and they see this island paradise full of, you know, possibly wide-open niches that they can exploit without a lot of competition. And then there comes this, what they call an adaptive radiation of all of the different unique species that come from those primitive animals. And you have to think about this. Fusa are so good at what they do. There's nothing naturally occurring in the forests of Madagascar now that the fusa can't take and eat, that there probably hasn't been a lot of drive for this thing to need to change over time, simply because it's so well adapted for doing what it does. Madagascar has rainforests on the east coast. It has dry forests on the west coast. The canopies and the forest habitats are very different there, but no more different than the spiny deserts that are in the southwest and the south of Madagascar. But the top predator for all of these habitat types on this island, which is a very large island, it's the world's fourth largest island, the size of California and Oregon put together, the top predator on this whole island in all of these habitat types is the fusa.
Does it look different from habitat to habitat? Has it changed? Would you be able to tell? No. Wow.
No, it looks the same throughout. Huh. Now, you'll see different lemur species, maybe the same representatives of the same genus or so in all of these different habitat types. But it's really amazing how the fusa is just really good at needing to do whatever it needs to do in whichever habitat it's in, that you haven't seen a species division of that animal.
Part of your success is the ability to eat anything and be good at getting it. That's good. So we've identified that's part of the strength of the fusa. What about its competitors? You have to beat them, too, and they have to, you have to be in a place where they're not. What kind of competitors
does
it have?
Well, that's part of the reason for the fusa's success as well, because when you have this predator that's much larger than the next largest carnivore on the island, there is no competition. So why would you need to change? If you show up and you're instantly the boss, keep doing what you're doing.
The problem for some animals, like, say, humans, for instance, is once they get to be the boss, they wipe everything out. I mean, why didn't that happen? Why didn't they get so successful that they actually, you know, sort of left themselves hungry?
Well, this is an interesting biological phenomenon. As predators get more and more successful, and they will have more offspring because they have more energy at a certain period of time, they will begin to overeat their prey. What happens then is the prey populations decline. There's not enough energy to support that big population of super predators or predators or what we call keystone species around there. And naturally, in subsequent generations, there'll be fewer of them. When there are fewer of them, the prey populations can bounce back. When the prey populations bounce back, there's more for the predator to eat as well. And so there's this out-of-sync cycle between predators and prey over time in areas that aren't disturbed and having all sorts of other things going on to mess them up, that is a naturally occurring balance of nature. And that's why it's actually important, even though we may be concerned about lemur conservation, to understand and respect that because there's a predator of these lemurs there, it's not necessarily a bad thing, because in nature, they maintain their own balance over time.
So what's happening to the fusa population?
Well, the fusa population, like most populations of all animals in Madagascar, is on the decline. Madagascar has well under 10% of its original standing forests remaining. And most of this has been lost within the last century. Madagascar was first colonized by people 1,500 to 2,000 years ago. So it was a recent arrival of humans on this great big island, and then a very recent depletion, if you think of things in geological time, of all of those habitats there. And that's why when you combine the unique nature of everything you find on Madagascar with this just rampant loss of deforestation because the human condition there naturally relies on subsistence agriculture. Madagascar is often called the world's top biodiversity conservation priority because of the rate of loss of the ecosystems there, and the growth rates of humans and the uniqueness of everything that one finds there make this interesting combination of factors that really do indicate a great crisis for the future of Madagascar's nature.
And it seems to me a challenging problem, because what I hear you saying, it is that is the native population having that's expanding on the on the island, and it has expanded pretty dramatically over the past.
Indeed. When I first went to Madagascar as an undergraduate at Duke in 1994, there were about 12 million people on Madagascar. Madagascar now has about 24 million people on it. So the population size has doubled in just over 20 years. This indicates a big problem. If 3/4 of your populace, roughly, rely on natural resources to turn habitat into agricultural fields in order to eat, it doesn't take a lot of insight to see that there's a conundrum there. There's a conservation crisis where, you know, human populations and wildlife interests are going to collide. The interesting thing is we all need those forests in order to maintain the integrity of the soils and the agricultural fields as well. And when we lose them, you then see people having to expand into additional areas to grow more and more food. Madagascar is definitely in a unique position that is both imperiled and with hope.
Well, what is the hope? Because, again, you're talking about a local population that's trying to feed itself. That's no simple problem. And you don't just say, stop feeding yourself and stop expanding. So how are the people of Madagascar and the Malagasy Republic on board with this? And is there a way to do it and still provide for the population?
You can never blame someone for feeding themselves versus not feeding themselves. But by and large, people do get this, particularly on the governmental and administrative levels. It's understood that something's got to happen. More things have got to happen, because things are happening now. But more things have to happen in order to address this. We work more with local communities now, actually, than we actually do collecting the same data that, and the same types of data that we've been collecting for decades at this point, trying to find a balance and solutions for this. There's sort of a two-pronged approach. We have to find an immediate alternative to this ongoing practice of slash-and-burn agriculture, which has been the main problem. There's illegal logging and exports and things like that that definitely contribute and shouldn't be overlooked. But by and large, it's the human condition that makes such a great problem. So particularly in the protected areas, which is where you find most of the remaining forests, our research team and lots of other biologists and some conservation NGOs as well are actually working with the local communities to capitalize on what's in their backyard to show others. Madagascar really does have a great economy based in ecotourism. The economy itself is not phenomenal, but ecotourism is a major boon to what you know economic good is happening in Madagascar. And by being able to capitalize on what's in one's backyard versus having to cut it down in order to feed yourself for one or maybe two growing seasons only, you have this perpetual solution. Mm. It's not the magic bullet, but it's certainly a way to immediately address the problems that provides a solution that can be invested in those places while we try to alleviate the condition, the fact that, you know, there are not opportunities for advancement as much as we would see here. Education is not as immediately prevalent throughout the rural countryside. So in the first prong, you address the immediate problems by finding an alternative. In the second one, you do see economic development and specifically investing in education, because if people have educational opportunities within a generation, they're going to want to move away from this status of being a subsistence agriculture type person, where you know it's a hard life and it's a very insecure life, because from one season to the next you are at mercy of what nature dishes out to you. And so within a generation, we can hopefully see these problems begin to be alleviated, because this really is, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, given the human population size and this conservation conundrum that we're seeing, within our lifetimes, possibly one of Madagascar's last chances.
On the hunch that you were involved in this research before the movie came out, what got you interested in the FUSA?
What got me interested in the FUSA was the thing that Madagascar is most famous for most of the world, and that is the lemurs. I was an undergraduate at Duke. In fact, I got my bachelor's, master's, and PhD all from Duke. They couldn't really get rid of me and still can't. But the lemurs, You can't really, if you want to be cynical about it, it's hard to throw a rock at a group of biologists in Madagascar and not hit a primatologist. There are a lot of primatologists there, but that's because these populations are so amazing. Duke has a lemur center. It was called the Duke Primate Center back when I was an undergrad. Now it's called the Duke Lemur Center, which is an amazing facility. It's the world's largest captive colony of lemurs anywhere on Earth. It's just extraordinary. And I, before I even started my freshman year, got a job at the Lemur Center shoveling lemur poop.
Ah, there you go.
And really kind of worked my way up from shoveling lemur poop to...
Where else is there to go?
Yeah, actually convincing someone to let me study the lemurs that were there. And by the end of my junior year, had convinced one of the professors there to take me to Madagascar.
You actually have a great story about sort of losing a lemur and finding a fusa, or at least evidence of a fusa.
So I get to Madagascar the summer after my junior year. Here I am, 21 years old, my first major international travel. I'm in the rainforests of Madagascar, living out of a tent, several hours walk from the nearest road, and we are studying these lemurs. And we're going up hills and down hills. And the lemurs, it's pretty easy because they just have to go straight across the canopy. They're about cat size. But we're down on the ground trying to chase them and see what they're eating. The lemur that I was following actually had an old non-functioning radio collar, but it had a big battery pack and a whip antenna. So you give it to the new guy. It's easy for him to follow that one and look at what it's eating and collect data on all the food it's eating. And one day, this lemur just disappeared from the group. Now, we were studying an entire social group of lemurs there. And sometimes, just with any social group, one animal may break away and come back a few days later or something like that. So I wasn't particularly worried about it. But a few days later, we went to find this group by using the frequency of the radio collar in the group that was functional. And we were hearing the beep of that radio collar, but we suddenly started hearing a clicking on a different frequency, and we dialed into that click. And when we dialed into that click, it was the frequency of this collar of the animal, Stanzi, that had disappeared a few days later and hadn't worked for years. So our curiosity was piqued, and we tracked into where it had to be, and we were looking up in the trees for this lemur lump that had to be Stanzi, and we couldn't find it. Then we looked down. There were a few clumps of fur, a few bone fragments, and a radio collar. The predator that had eaten Stanzi in the course of devouring the animal had also chewed on the battery pack of this radio collar and apparently reconnected the battery wires. And that was the first time in my entire life I heard the word fusa.
If you want to hear more about Luke Dollar's experiences with fusa, you can go to the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh tomorrow at 7. It's part of the Extreme Mammals exhibit. Luke is a professor of biology at Pfeiffer University and a researcher for National Geographic. Luke, a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.